Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Wild Tales podcast. I'm Jason Fox, and this series is all about adventure, resilience, and inspirational humans. The podcast is presented by The Book of Man and sponsored by Talisker Single Malt Whiskey. My guest today is Patrick Hutchinson, one of the most incredible men to have emerged in 2020. A photo of him rescuing a counter-protester to safety during a Black Lives Matter protest in June became instantly iconic and catapulted the personal trainer to worldwide fame. I talked to him about the incident and his book, Everyone Versus Racism, A Letter to My Children. You've also been suggesting questions to ask on Instagram. Because it's Christmas, we'll send a Talisker Sea Salted Caramel gift set to the one I pick out. Anyway, here we go. I really hope you enjoy the episode. Patrick, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on. It's been a mental year, to be honest. We're coming towards the end of it. But before we go into 2020, can you tell us about your early life? Where did you grow up? What kind of kid you were?
All right. Well, it's an also honour to speak to you, Mr. Fox. The feeling's mutual. Basically, as a young man, I sort of grew up in the Battersea, Clapham area. Originally, I was born in Coventry. My mum, we came down, I think when I was about 4 years old, when I came to London, and South London was the spot. And yeah, Battersea and Clapham is where I sort of grew up. I went to school up in Wandsworth. So it was all in that, you know, in that global area.
I know it well, yeah. What was it? I mean, why? What was the reason for moving down from Coventry?
So for those of you that don't really know what Coventry is like, I guess back then, I'm not going to say anything negative about Coventry now, because I don't live there now. But back then, when my mum was in her early 20s, it was quite a boring place. And she'd met my father down in London, and that was kind of the place to be, I guess. So when she had me, she decided to move to London.
Right, okay. How old are you, Patrick? Sorry.
I'm 50. 50. All big 5-0, right, okay. Man. Yeah.
Big 5-0. What was your childhood like down here in Battersea, Clapham way? Was it hard? Were you outdoorsy? You know, give us an idea of what it was like to be down here, especially moving from Coventry.
So, I mean, I was like a sort of an outdoors lad. I liked sport and, you know, like as you do, but I didn't get the opportunity to do as much as I would have liked, because my mum was a single mum, and I used to have to look after my little sister when she went to work and stuff. So when my mates were out playing, I didn't always get to go out as well or go and play football or do whatever, because I was always looking after my little sister. And there were times when I left her alone, actually, and went out and then got caught and then got in a lot of trouble. But that's another story. But I was a bit shy, a bit... I feel like I was a bit reserved and a bit shy and a bit insecure.
Yeah.
But when I found martial arts and stuff like that, it brought me out of my shell a bit more. But generally, I was quite a caring and quiet lad. I was raised by mainly women. So I had that caring streak in me from the get-go, you know, just surrounded by lots of love and lots of kisses and hugs from my mum and my aunts and stuff and any of the women in my life. So that's sort of where that side of me comes from.
Yeah, yeah. What age did you get into martial arts then?
So I used to watch, I was watching like martial arts movies and kung fu movies from an early age. My mum and I, my sister, we used to sit and watch them, and I started watching them at probably about 8 or 9. And then obviously, you know, you start mimicking the moves and practicing all the kicks without any instructions. And then I had a mate at school that took up taekwondo. And he used to teach me lots of the moves. And then I decided I was going to take it up myself. So I think I was about 11, 12 when I finally like joined the Taekwondo club.
Yeah, yeah.
After you know, like months of begging my mum to let me go, you know.
And that reminds me of like me and my little brother actually when we were kids, because I remember the time when my old man they rented a VHS video. It's like a big thing. Video. And then my dad was like, there was a video store near us in Luton called Magnum. I don't know why I remember this. And the first DVD, the first videos he brought home was like the Bruce Lee ones, you know, like
I loved them.
and it proper did my mum's head in, because me and my brother were running around with like the pool cues and just whacking each other around each other's heads. Yeah, it was an epic.
Those were quality. Those were the acting was diabolical, man.
it's horrendous. I actually had a look at some of the clips from some of it was like over a year ago, but I was like, what the f- am I watching? Even Chuck Norris was bad.
Oh yeah, they were all bad, man. It was terrible, man.
It was all times though.
Yeah.
What were you like at school? The reason I ask is because I was rubbish at school. I had no interest in it, and I think that's why I pursued that's why I went down the route I did, was because I had to get away from where I was and be outdoors. But what were you like at school, and what influenced you after school?
I wasn't too bad at school, to be honest, Jason. I was like just above average. So you have the sets, and I wasn't in the top tier, but I was above the average. I was above the middle kids, and I was sort of in between the top and the middle kids. So in that space where if you work really hard, you can probably get to the top set. But if you start mucking around, you'll end up in the middle set. So I was sort of in that space there. I did get involved in a lot of mix up at school, because I had like mates that were all always up to no good. And I was like, you know, following along with them. So I got myself into a lot of trouble here and there. A lot of it to do with Taekwondo. I used to be kicking things in, practicing kicks and breaking things and stuff, and we all used to get in a bit of trouble. But once I realised the heartache it was giving my mum, I kind of sort of stopped a lot of that stuff. So I was always the kid that, when they spoke to my mum, they would say, he's got a lot of potential, so you've got to get him away from all of this nonsense. Yeah, so I wasn't the guy that sort of they'd given up on. It was like, he's got a lot of potential, but he's got to stop doing all this stuff.
So did your mum have that influence on you to get you away from that nonsense?
It was the love of my mum and the disappointment, you know, because I got in trouble at school a bit, and then outside of school I got arrested a few times for nothing hugely serious, just being a young man, right, and following the wrong crowd. And then it was like seeing her disappointment of coming to pick me up from police stations and seeing how upset she was. And because it was only her that raised my sister and I felt I was really, really letting her down. And it was just that disappointment on her face and how upset she got is what sort of pulled me around in the end.
It's always, it's the disappointment, isn't it? It's not the anger.
Disappointment. I use that on my children, you know, the disappointment.
Because you know it's so powerful.
Yeah, it's so much more powerful. You're right. Than being angry, just show disappointment, like it cuts them up.
Anger looks so uncool, doesn't it? It's just an uncool thing, you know.
Yeah.
If you want to be cool, don't be angry. But yeah. Did you sort of like cut school away at 16, or did you persevere with education?
Yeah, so I finished my education. I went to school in Wandsworth, finished my education, then went to college also in Wandsworth.
Yeah.
And I did 2 years. I did an IT, a computer science BTEC course, it was at the time.
Yeah.
And that was supposed to propel me onto a university degree. But my girlfriend and I were expecting a baby, okay? And I couldn't then go on and go to uni for the next 3 or 4 years because I had a son to raise. So I just went and got a job straight away. So that was I didn't end up going to uni in the end, but I could have done. But
What did you end up doing?
So yeah, so after doing the IT BTEC course, I went on and started working in IT. I got a job in operations, IT operations. It's sort of like, of all the jobs in IT, it's sort of like the base level job, and you kind of work the computers overnight, do a lot of the printing. Back in the day, you did a lot of printing and stuff. And so, for example, I worked in investment banks, and you'd print the bank statements, and you would, you know, operate the computers and do sort of like a bit of a customer service to the those abroad, because obviously when we're sleeping, they're awake. Say for example, in America. So it was that I started doing in the early stages of my IT career.
Where was that then? Was that in the city?
That was in the heart of the city. Yeah, in the heart of the city. My first job was like on King William Street, middle of the city. And I was in the city for 25 years, roughly, almost. You know, I went on to do other jobs within the infrastructure, within IT, building servers and stuff like that. And then I ended up with project management.
Yeah, that must have been a bit buzzing, really, because, like, without being rude, when you started in IT, it was still a new thing, wasn't it? Because I got mates that, like, went into IT, and it was like no one really knew what it was all about, especially people like me, because like my mates would say, oh, I'm in IT, and I'm like, what does that mean? I ain't got a clue what a computer is, let alone what IT means. But it was like a growth industry, wasn't it, back then, from what I remember?
Yeah, the computers were huge. It wasn't like about servers and stuff like that. The computers they used to use magnetic tapes to back up things. It was really ancient back then. Do you know what I'm saying? It was like, that is when I enjoyed it, back, you know, when I first started it.
Yeah. Is it? So you say you did, when did you finish that? When did you finish in IT?
So I stopped IT when I was in my sort of early 40s, about 41, 42. It was just, it got a bit much, you know, office politics and all of that, because when I was younger, I didn't notice it so much when I was younger. But as I got older, as I hit 30, my 30s, I realised I didn't sort of like the characters I was working with. People were not my kind of people. Mm. And on a few occasions, I found myself talking to people outside of the office saying, listen, if you continue to behave the way you're behaving, then we might have to talk about this outside of the office, because you guys... Yeah. When you got your suits and ties on, you think that you're, I don't know, you know, like Barry Big, you know what, you know,
there's a toxic culture in a lot of that industry out there, especially in the sort of hubs of the cities. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot of egos.
Yeah, there's a lot of egos, Jason, and it's huge, and there's a lot of bullying, man. There's so much bullying, and any kind of bullying you can imagine, and it's just people of in positions of power taking the mick of other people who are trying to get to where they are and using them and abusing them. And it's horrible. Do you know what I mean? And once you realize that, as you get older, you thought, I don't want to be a part of this.
So what was the next chapter then? What did the next chapter look like?
Well, so for me, it was like people always said to me, you know, you should become a personal trainer, because, you know, I was always into training, always advising people to train and giving people advice and tips and stuff. And they said, yeah, you should get into training. So it was almost like, I'm 40, 42. I ain't got a lot of time. I ain't got 7 years to go and train to be a doctor or a lawyer or anything else. You know, it's anything that's going to take up a lot of time. I need to do something quickly. So, you know, being a personal trainer seemed to be the one. Yeah. So I did my certifications. And then I got approached by a friend, someone who's a really good friend of mine now, Paul Miller. Who I bumped into at an athletics competition, because my niece was a little budding sprinter, and I used to take her along.
Yeah.
And he approached me. And then I got into coaching athletics, and I did my qualifications with, UK Athletics. So I'm also a certified athletics coach, and I sort of coupled the personal training with the athletics coaching, and I did that. And that was my new way to make money.
A lot more fun than hanging around with egomaniacs as well.
Yeah, definitely. Especially when you come to coaching the young people and the children, it was a lot more fun.
Yeah. That's awesome. Not that I'm any good at athletics. I'm pretty poor, to be honest, but there we go. Okay, so that's, I'm going to start on the beginning of this year. I mean, this year has been mental, to say the least, for a lot more people than me. You know, I've just been bore witness to a lot of it, really. And I've also been lucky enough to work, but What were you doing at the start of the year? Can you remember?
So, yeah, I mean, at the start of the year, I was doing my athletics. The athletics coaching took over my PTing. So although I originally, you know, became a personal trainer, the athletics coaching really took off more so. And so that was what I was doing. And sort of the PTing was very minimal. So you'd get like, you know, individuals who have their children in some really top schools, you know, some top independent schools. So, for example, a man might have his son playing rugby and he wants him to be quicker. So, you know, I could do one-on-ones with that young man to get to increase his speed, you know, and his running style, improve him, you know, all around, and also his fitness. So, you know, that was the sort of the avenue I was going down. And then I thought about becoming a mentor, because a couple of my young athletes, as you well know, Jason, a lot of the most talented children in sport are from impoverished backgrounds and poor backgrounds, right? So I had a lot of young sprinters who were getting a lot of trouble at school, and I would go down to the schools and talk with the head teachers where nobody else could sort of reason with these young people, just to show them the school, the other side to them, saying, listen, I coach them, you know, like 4 or 5 times a week, and they don't give me any trouble whatsoever. So it's obviously a bit of a breakdown in communication between you and this young person. And I was being called in to do this, you know, more and more. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to go in the sort of the mentoring role as well. And maybe go into some of these pupil referral units, you know, about those where the children that get kicked out of school go.
Yeah.
So so that was my aim, was to go into these PRUs, what they're called, and help some of these young men and girls, you know, get back into mainstream school if possible. And if not, just help to mentor them and sort of empower them a bit.
I think it's mega important that, because I'm like, I was probably one of those kids, and it's had me thinking. And I think a lot of the time the curriculum lets down those kids that, you know, the kids aren't very academic. The curriculum basically saying to them, you're going to amount to nothing. And that's why they become disassociated and disillusioned. And they're all they want to do is belong to something. Do you know what I mean? And to have a mentor, or to have a different focus, like an athletic coach or whatever the sport is, wherever you decide to go, it allows them to understand. And they're actually probably, I mean, you can vouch for it more than I can, but they're probably mega switched on young individuals. Do you know what I mean? They're just not that way inclined.
And this is the thing, like when I would go to the schools, I'd be saying to them, like, the young person you're talking about and telling me what the things they're getting up to isn't the person that I know trackside, because they're fully engaged in what we're doing, and I see the best of them. So definitely 100%. Like, obviously, from an academics perspective, some of these children are just not engaged, and they're not really bothering to try and engage them. And this is where they fall out of the system.
Mm. Yeah. It's where, and it happens a lot, especially in towns, isn't it? Downtowns and cities are where it just seems to, because there's so many kids, and, you know, it's not necessarily the teacher's fault, I suppose, but they're just they've got like milestones to it, or KPIs, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, they're the kids. I ain't got time for that, because there's just too many of them. But anyway, how did, I suppose, you know, March turns up, and I remember it being March, and everything started to look like it was, you know, as far as we knew, our normal was falling apart. What happened there with sort of like your coaching and the mentoring and all that sort of thing? I suppose it was going to be looking like it was going to put on hold. And then what happens to the kids? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, most of it sort of got switched off, and then everything sort of went online. So we would sort of do Zoom sessions online with the children. We would do some like workouts and some sort of like strength and conditioning stuff. But we'd also do some competitions and quizzes and stuff as well, just to try and keep them engaged. But yeah, everything sort of disappeared, mate. You know what I'm saying? It was tough. It was a struggle.
How long did that go on for you? I mean, for me, I came back and, you know, I just hold myself up and watched it all play out. But I mean, I take it you did the same, apart from doing those Zooms and trying to keep kids interested in whatever was available to them.
Yeah, it was that, and it was with my own children as well. Like, I mean, my youngest daughter, I felt like she dropped a couple of grades during the first lockdown, because, you know, like she's quite a smart girl, but I tell you what, like it seemed as if she went back a grade or two, because she was struggling to be. We were struggling to sort of get her engaged with work and stuff. She was just turned into a Roblox fiend. This is a game called Roblox that these young children play, and yeah, couldn't get her off of it. And at times, it was convenient for us just to have her quiet, because obviously a lot of us, like my missus, she'd be working, doing calls, Zoom calls, be doing whatever. And so you want them nice and quiet. And sometimes it was easy for them to just be on the iPad playing these games.
Yeah.
But it didn't take long before you realise it's sort of the damage it can do to them.
Yeah, it's horrible to think about it. You're like, when you're all in the house trying to vie for silence or trying to vie for your own space, it's, I don't know what you do. Because a lot of it's appeasing. It's like, yeah, just shut up, whatever.
Yeah,
and then all of a sudden, suddenly realise that it's going on a lot longer. But then obviously, we're going to talk primarily about 2020 because there's been a shitload happen. But then obviously, the events over in the US, with George Floyd, I'm not the best place to talk about it, and that's why you're here. But can you tell us about your journey with that?
Well, in terms of George Floyd's story, there were a few other stories that were that were going around, especially the Breonna Taylor one.
Yeah.
And when George Floyd, I'd heard about it before I saw the video. People were like saying, have you seen the video of George Floyd? And it was one of those moments, when you hear that there's something that's gone viral, and I'm always at a place, do I actually want to see what people are talking about? Because you're hearing how harrowing it is and how despicable it is. And I think to myself, do I want to see this? Do I really want to see it? And I thought, I don't want to see it. But then it was like, I know I have to see it.
Mm.
And then when I watched it, Jason, I literally cried, mate. Honestly, I cried. Because it was, even when I talk about it, sometimes it makes me, I get a bit funny because it was the nonchalance of the officer, like looking into the camera, staring at, and he had his hands in his pockets. I can just see him now with his knee in George's neck. And he was just looking like, what are you going to do? And then it was these officers as well around him that were just all complicit, because not one of them had the sense to say, listen, mate, you've gone too far. They were just doing crowd control and watching him do what he was doing. And it just, it was sickening, mate. It was sickening.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've ever seen anything that's had that much of an impact on me. And I've seen some disgusting things sent around the internet at times, that one thing, there's a point where he's died, he's dead, he's passed away. Like your knee's still on his neck and the bloke's dead. He's not talking, he's not breathing. That had me like thinking a lot about, like, I just felt, I felt really helpless. Like, I thought, what can I do sitting here in the front room, watching this stuff? What can I do? There's nothing I can do. And then one of my mates, Jermaine Facey, he's one of the four guys that went with us on the day. He'd been down to the march where the policewoman got felled off her horse.
Yeah.
So he'd been down to that particular demonstration, and he was right at the front line of it, watching what was happening.
Mm.
And he explained to me that the horses, the police on the horses, they rushed the protesters with the horses, and the young protesters, they had, few of them had Boris bikes, so they threw the Boris bikes in way of the horses to protect themselves. So then the horses panic, and then obviously all the police officers are trying to keep the horses under control.
Yeah.
But this one policewoman, she lost control of her horse because she couldn't control the horse, and it clotheslined her into a lamppost, and that's how she fell off the horse. And then the horse gallops off and takes out a couple of civilians in the process as well, and then gallops off back to the stables, I think.
Yeah.
And then he saw that, and the mayhem that it caused, it was absolute mayhem, he said. And he looked around and he didn't see any of the older, experienced people in the community. Like, we know a lot of security guys, some ex-forces guys as well, some personal trainers, and some just and martial artists. We know a lot of these people in our circle, and we didn't see any of them. He just said all he could see was young people. So when he got back from that demonstration, he put a shout out on his Instagram Live and his Facebook Live, having a bit of a rant, saying like, "Where were we all? None of us are out here protecting the youngsters, and we need to do better." So then when Tommy Robinson put his shout out, whenever it was, a few days later, to the football thugs and EDL guys, we thought, right, this is our time. We need to make sure we go down there to help protect and keep the order, because we knew that it was just going to kick off big time.
So what can you talk about that day then? You know, we're obviously building up to the obvious, but, you know, the older guys within your community, you've put that shout out, you know, I suppose it's a necessary thing to have older, more wiser heads in a situation like that, because it helps get the message across. Because if everything spins into chaos, messages are lost, aren't they? And all anyone ever focuses on is the shit, and the unnecessary noise, I suppose. But how did that day start for you, and then pan out?
So prior to going out on that day, there was a lot of when Jermaine had put that call out, that shout out.
Yeah.
There was a lot of negative feedback, and people were saying that it's a trap, you know. It's a draw out, as they like to say on the streets, because they're saying that if we go down there, it's going to kick off, and then the whole of the BLM movement's going to be derailed, and they're going to focus on us being thugs.
Yeah.
But what we were trying to explain is that we weren't going down there to fight. For those who are young and less experienced, they might be going down there to have a tear up. Those are the ones that we need to keep away from the situation. But as for us, we were going down there to help stop all of that stuff, so we had to be there, you know.
Yeah.
So after we put that shout out, so my on the day, I was actually busy on the day. I had my grandchildren, my grandson and my granddaughter, and my two daughters. We were just hanging out, looking after my grandchildren. And then the mate, he comes and he says, you know, we got to go down there. And I said, like, you know, I'm sure you've got enough numbers. I'm gonna have to sit this one out, because I've already promised to babysit.
Yeah.
And then he says, there's only five of us, including you. So as you can imagine, I know you can appreciate it, obviously.
He's mega batted the ball back into your court, hasn't he?
Exactly. So, like, you know, you're not going to leave your brothers, like, in a hole like that, you know. So I just had to, you know, sort out the babysitting situation. And I had to go down there with him, because of, you know, I made number five. And then in the end, we had another guy on the that met us on the way. So there were six of us in total going down there to God knows what, you know what I mean? Yeah. So that was how the day started. Like, it didn't start off too well. So yeah, that was the beginning of the day.
So where did you, where were you heading? So you're obviously at home. Where exactly were you going in town? Or what, like, because how do I explain what I'm trying to ask? It's like, there was a lot of stuff going on all over the place, but how did you choose a position to go? Where did you choose to go and why?
So we knew that the main demonstration was at Trafalgar Square. So we were heading there, but en route, we'd heard that there was going to be a demonstration also outside the US Embassy, which was in Vauxhall. So we went around there. And that turned out to be a lie. So we ended up going over to Trafalgar Square. So we were, you know, walking over Vauxhall Bridge. And then we realized there were so many diversions and cutoffs already that we couldn't get to where we were going. So we had to go back and jump on the underground in the end.
Right.
And in doing so, we jumped on the underground, and there were like pockets of, there was six of us. In the end, it ended up being just five of us in the end, because one of us decided there was too much walking up and down. I want to go home, so he went. But on the underground, so there were five of us, and there were pockets of like the football guy, the hooligans, in various carriages and stuff. So, you know, you can I mentioned this in my book actually. You can sort of see each other there, and there's this look. That you give each other this look, and it's like not here. It's like it's not going to go down here. When we get off and get to Trafalgar Square, then it's going to kick off. And you could see that look in their eyes. You know what I mean? Like, it was an unspoken thing where everybody's going to just stay cordial on the underground, and we'll save it for when we get there. That sort of look. So we knew we weren't going there for a tear up. Do you know what I mean? Like we've got nothing to prove. But obviously when you see, unfortunately, when you see a group of black guys, they're going to think that that's what we're going there for, I guess. You know, they don't realize that we're a little bit older and got a bit more experience about us. And, you know, we see things differently.
I just don't get my head around. I can't get my head around why they're like, right, we're just going to have a tear up because they're black guys.
Yeah.
It's like, I find it difficult to understand that mentality. You know, there's no actual beef. Do you know what I mean?
Apparently they were protecting statues, but all the statues they were protecting, Jason, have already been boarded up.
Yeah.
You can see the Churchill statue was boarded up and all the other statues have been boarded up.
Yeah,
so there was no need to protect statues at all, you know. So you're obviously going down there.
You're going there for a scrap, that's it.
Yeah, that's why you're going there.
You have the old Mexican standoff on the tube.
Yeah.
Where did you get off then? Did you get off at Trafalgar Square?
I think we got off at Trafalgar Square. Right. I don't even remember exactly what station it was, but I know we got off and then we walked for a bit. And then when we got to we couldn't get to the centre of the hub. We could see it kicking off. You know, like, I don't know if you saw, there was some footage on the news of the police and the, you know, the football hooligans, though, they're having a bit of a scrap. And we could see it, but we couldn't get to it because they cordoned, it was all cordoned off, you know.
Yeah,
they kept telling us to go around. So that part, that bit in the centre there, we didn't actually get to see it or get in there because we couldn't get to it. It was all cordoned off.
Yeah.
So the issues that we found were later on down by Waterloo. So after that had happened, when we did get into Trafalgar, things had died down. And then you go around and you're talking to everybody and you're hearing what happened and what unfolded and that. And then they start to chaperone everybody over to Waterloo. I guess it was their way of dispersing everybody. They sort of started to, you know, with the horses and the riot police and stuff, everybody started to be, you know, shoved towards the Waterloo. So we all walked over the bridge, Waterloo Bridge, and then we ended up by the station and in between the embankment and the near the Royal Opera House, all in that area.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that's where there were pockets of things that started to happen here and there, but which I'll tell you about in a sec.
Yeah, so...
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You've got down that way, and what was happening?
So. As you can imagine, there was lots and lots of a few hundreds people there. And every now and again, something's kicking off somewhere and people are rushing to one side and there's a mini fight taking place. I think there's still pockets of EDL guys in the area and things are happening. So the first thing that we stopped was a young man. He was doing some graffiti. He had like a fist template and he was using it and spraying it all over things. And, you know, there was a load of old Bill, like, just standing there watching him. And we pulled him up. He said, listen, well, the old Bill got hold of him first. And we sort of got over there and intervened and said, like, we'll take care of it, officer. Don't worry about it. And the policeman let us speak to him. And we said, listen, what are you doing? Like, you're doing this. And all, look behind you. There's, like, fucking rows of meat wagons, like, lined up. And you're spraying and doing graffiti. So we took all the stuff from him, gave it to the police. And he... gave him a bit of a ticking off. He was a bit upset to start with, but then he realised what we were saying made sense and he went on his merry way. So that was the first thing that we sorted.
Yeah.
The next thing was there was a young lad who they all of a sudden decided, young white lad, all of a sudden they decided he was EDL. They just started saying, EDL, EDL. And he must have thought, what's going on? I'm with you. right? Yeah. And they started running after him. So we like got there and said, no, he's been with you the whole time. He's not EDL. Like, and we stopped that, you know, from unfolding, because God knows what would have happened, you know, because when he's not in a herd mentality, they just do stupid things, don't they? So
yeah,
that was that. Then there was a car come out of nowhere. Some people say that they had EDL members inside the car, but I can't confirm that. Well, I know that there was a couple of guys in a car, white guys in a car, driving through the bloody crowd. So, of course, the crowd reacts. They try to smash the car to bits, and it's just it's just mayhem. So, like, we basically, like, pull people off the car, have a go at the guys inside the car, like, what are you doing? And just get out of here. And then they drive on. So we stop that from happening. It was crazy. And then we come to that fateful moment where we're sort of standing a little bit away. And then one of us sort of notices a bit of a scrap at the top of the stairs. So there's a stairs that lead from the up to the embankment. Yeah.
It's on the bridge, isn't it? Is that
yeah.
right?
And it's yeah. at the side of the Royal Opera House. Where
I know, called, yeah, yeah, right? Sorry. Yeah. yeah.
So there's a scrap going on up top of there. Looks like EDL guys and Black Lives Matter protesters all having a tear up. So we thought, we better get over there. So as we get over there, the EDL guys have run off. One guy's just left there. He looks completely out of it. Like, yeah. He definitely looked like he might have been a bit concussed. He just didn't know where he was. And then there was a few of the Black Lives Matter protesters like sort of protecting him. And there was a Rasta guy. I always make reference to this Rastafarian guy.
Yeah.
That was like, he was sort of holding him and sort of cradling him and just telling people to just chill. But as more and more people realised what had happened and who he was, that he was an EDL, they all started to come and try and get digs in here and there.
Yeah.
And we saw it from a distance. We thought we'd better get over there really, really quickly. And as we get over there, like, it's like hundreds of people like about to descend on this Rasta guy. And there was a couple of other people trying to help him, but they were just outnumbered. And then by the time we managed to get to the stairs, you couldn't even see where the guy was because it was a sea of people. So he had fallen and he was under on the stairs somewhere.
Yeah.
So then we start sifting through people, like just dragging people by their collars, like just dragging about the way until we see him. And he was sort of lying in the fetal position on one of the steps. Obviously been on the receiving end of a bit of a kick in. So
yeah,
like the guys were sort of like, were just trying to push people away and protect him. And then I just thought, like, it makes no sense standing here because we're just all going to get trampled at some point because we're just going to be outnumbered. Yeah. So he was on the floor. He was lying in the fetal position. We managed to see him. The guys were there sort of like making like a barrier around, stop people from getting to him. But like common sense told me that we ain't going to be able to protect him here for long because there's just too many people, right? So I just thought, I'm going to pick him up and carry him over to the police because the police were like a few yards away. They were just there filming everything. So I just like scooped him up, mate, threw him on my shoulder and just sort of walked him out. And then the guys, people were like sort of protecting me as I carried him out, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that was it, mate. Like, I mean, at the time, I didn't even realise there were that anyone had caught it on camera or video footage. But then when I watched it back, you could see all the people with their cameras taking pictures and, you know, yeah. And that was it, mate.
Sounds like a mental day. But like,
it was.
Ultimately, there would have been no good for anyone come from that. I take it that's the way you were thinking anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
What happened? So you got him away. What did you do? Just pat him down, make sure he's all right, and be like, you know, what are you doing? You know, this shit isn't good anyway. You've just found that out.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even speak to him because he was out of it, mate. Honestly, he wasn't even there. So I just put him down, gave him to one of the police officers. Listen, there you go, and that was it. Went on my merry way. And then I did see later on that there was an ambulance and they had him in an ambulance, but. Yeah. But yeah, that was it. I never spoke to him on the day.
Yeah.
And haven't since. Like, yeah, that was it.
Never spoke to him since or nothing?
No, you know. So that's it.
Wonder what happened to him, wonder where he is. How long were you out there for after that? Was that it? You went home or?
So after that, we sort of hung around a bit more. We were kind of just waiting for the the crowds to really disperse. Because one of the guys that we were with on a day, he runs a security firm. So he's very much of, you know, he's one that noticed when it started kicking off on the stairs and said, we need to get over there. And he's the one that would sort of say to us, okay, let's just hang around a little bit more until people start to go. Because once the numbers wane, then we'll go, you know, and which is what we did. We sort of waited for people to go, and that coincided with us, with our bellies calling us as well. So then we we went on our merry way, man, went home.
There isn't the right people in certain places to defuse. It's all about de-escalation.
Yeah.
You know, conflict management, it's a difficult thing, and you have to have the right people in the right place. And sometimes that doesn't happen, and that's what I think kicks off. So, you know, the fact that you guys were there with the right mindset is why you were best placed, and you were the best people there to do it. I think it's a mental day. When did it sort of become a bit viral? Because it went viral, didn't it? Like, more than viral, it went global.
Yeah. I mean, so we made our way to a place called Eat of Eden, which is sort of in Clapham, in between Acre Lane and Clapham. I know. We were outside there because obviously you couldn't go inside because of COVID. So we ordered some stuff and we were sitting outside having a bit of a munch. And my phone started popping off. Like, people sending me, my sister was the first one actually to send me this picture saying, is this you, bruv? Like, and this is the first time I've seen this picture. I'm thinking, so I just said, yeah, it was me. I said, yeah. And I was looking at it thinking, damn shit, it's been caught on camera. And she said, what are you doing there? And I said, oh, we were just there trying to keep the peace, blah, blah, blah. She said, you know, this is from my mate sent it to me. And she said, it's come from Reuters. You know what that means? I said, no. She said, it means it's probably going to go viral. This is coming from Reuters feed. And then there was a video as well. And it just like, it was like showing a bit of the mayhem. Like, and I thought, wow. So when she sent it to me, I showed the guys and they were going, oh shit. Like, and then I thought, you know what, let me put it on my Instagram. So I put it on my Instagram and then I put, it's not black versus white, it's everybody versus the racists. I just coined the phrase at the time, it just came to me. And then before you know it, I start getting lots of hits. All our phones start to ping off because the guys then they grab it, I think, put on their pages and whatever. And it just, our phone just went mental. My phone went absolutely berserk. I was getting phone calls. People say, is this you? Is this you? A lot of people didn't recognize me, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of people were second guessing if it was me or not. It was mad. And the time from then to Monday morning. So as you can imagine, that was on Saturday. Then there was Sunday. My phone rang and messages all Sunday from all media outlets, you name them, trying to get me, line me up for Monday morning. It was absolutely mental. And so Channel 4 were the first ones to get hold of us because one of the guys in Channel 4 knew a mate of mine. And the guy said, oh, he knows me. And so I sort of spoke to them first.
Yeah.
And from Channel 4, speaking to them, I think I met them. We met about 6 in the morning, I think. Something like that. It was crazy. We never left that park until well into the after. Like, basically, they were queuing up after Channel 4 had finished with us. Then it was whoever next. And then who after that. It was mad. The park just turned into some sort of media outlet. It was crazy.
But it's just like, that was the first day, but then, you know, it has gone from like, you've gone from the guy that's mentoring young athletes and whatnot, and next thing you know, you're all over GQ and stuff like that.
It's been insane. I mean, the first month, like a friend of like one of the athletes that I coached, her mother, a young lady called Tara, her mum called Geeta Bartlett, I always give her a shout out. She reached out to me because she worked in PR previously and she knew that what was about to happen to me. So she basically said, listen, I'll just put everybody through to me and I'll manage all the interviews and stuff. And I did that for 4 weeks before my management team come on board. And she basically saved my life. Like, I even credit her in the end of my book, because without her, I don't know what I would have done. She just navigated things in the right way, decided who I should speak to, who I shouldn't speak to, when I should speak to them. And she was tremendous.
Mate, you actually talking about talk to that person, don't talk to this person, putting you in front of different people. What was the interview like with Prince Harry?
I've spoken to quite a few people that I've really enjoyed and met a lot of people. But the two people that I've spoken to that like really was like, wow, it was Reverend Al Sharpton and Prince Harry. And when I spoke to Prince Harry, it was literally like talking to a mate. Like it was just really cool. You know what I mean? It was really relaxed atmosphere. And it was just like me and a laptop and Prince Harry. And it was just incredible, man. And we were just talking. I hope it came across as genuine and It came across as authentic, because it did feel really authentic. And he sounded really genuine in all the stuff that he was saying. And the fact that he's now married to a mixed race woman, he feels like he experiences and understands what's happening with systemic racism, unconscious bias. He kind of gets it because he sees it with his own eyes now. Whereas before, the life he lived, he would have been sheltered from all of this stuff and he wouldn't even have noticed it or knew it existed even.
Yeah. It's mad that the phrase that you came up with for your Instagram post, it's not, black against white, it's everyone against racism. That's quite, it's quite profound, isn't it? It's mad that it just comes to you when you're sat down on Acre Lane having a bit of a munch.
it's mad because, at the time I said the racists, and it's since spawned into racism because obviously it's bigger than saying racism. But even I sit down and I sort of pat myself on the back, and there's lots of you can get a quote from Gandhi, you can get a quote from Nelson Mandela, you can get a quote from Muhammad Ali. That's going to be my quote. Do you know what I mean?
Mate, it's quality. You can get a quote from Patrick Hutchins.
I know. For years to come, and I'm so it's like, wow. How did you think of that? It's mad.
Moving a little bit away from that, there's been a lot happened because of that, and rightly so. But you've obviously got a new organisation. Can you tell us about it? What it does? What it's called? I know what it's called, but I want you to tell everyone what it's called.
Yeah, UKI. United to Change and Inspire. We like to think. There's so many different reasons why we use the name, but one of the for me it was like we were united today on the day as concerned parents. I say parents instead of brothers, because sometimes when you say brothers or fathers, it almost like it omits, the women or whatever. So if I say concerned parents, that just puts everybody in the perspective. So we were united on the day going down there, and we like to think that we changed the narrative, because there are lots of negative stereotypes, Jason, of black men, unfortunately, out there in the media. And we like to think that we've helped change that narrative, and we're trying to inspire everybody else, to be like us, where possible, intervene, don't allow things to... I think the problem with nowadays, Jason, is that things happen, unfold on the street, and people are so bothered about filming. And yes, things do need to be filmed because you need at least one bit of footage, okay? But not everybody needs to be filming it, right? Yeah. All the other people that are filming could actually intervene. I so believe that there's powers in numbers. And if someone's doing something that's a bit naughty out there, 10 or 15 people confront that one person, he's not going to take on everybody. He's going to run for it, right? So I believe that there's power in numbers. So I want to inspire others to do like what we did on that day, like when we intervened and we did what was right, regardless of the politics of anybody. We just worried about that late. Don't worry about that in that moment. In that moment in time, you do the right thing. And that's what we're trying to do.
Man, I love it. I agree with it totally as well, because ultimately we're in a society which means there's lots of other people with different, we're all different, and we should all be like looking out for each other, because that's the whole point of the society. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
I'm totally with you. You hear about so many times where people just sit by and stand by and watch stuff happen. You're like, you can have a go at the person that's doing wrong, but you're not contributing to the society anyway either.
If you stand there watching something, you're almost complicit, because especially if you're physically capable of doing something about it, then I feel like it's your duty to do that. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like sitting around watching things isn't the one, mate.
100%.
But to lead on from that, so as an organisation, we're going to be sort of working at grassroots in various areas. We've got mental health, which is Chris Otakito, education, which is me. You've got the criminal justice system and reform, which is Jermaine Facey, and you've got youth development, which is Lee Russell. And each one of us is going to be championing these areas. And we're going to be working at grassroots level, but we're also going to be working, trying to in tandem with the policy makers and the people in power, so that we can help with some of the decisions that are made, that ultimately affect our community, you know, and hopefully we can be the glue in between.
But because you're essentially the subject matter experts when it comes to the community that you represent, because the people that make the decisions haven't got a fucking Scooby about the mindset and the, you know, the troubles, the difficulties, the highs, the lows of being in that area. So that's an amazing thing. Where can people find you, whether it's social media, where it's anything like that, and whereabouts are you sort of, you know, are you hoping to reach everyone everywhere?
So wherever we're required, that's where we're gonna be ultimately. And then the organization will ultimately be bigger than just, you know, the four initial founders. You know, we're all gonna, it's gonna grow, and hopefully we can make a real difference with what we're doing.
That's the organization, which is doing big things, but we got to talk about it. You've got a book. The book's awesome. The name's awesome. Can you talk about, how did the book come about? What's it about? I know, well.
A lot of people have a bucket list of things I'd like to do. And a lot of us will probably have either writing a book or being in a movie on that bucket list, you know. And for me, they're both on mine. And so, you know, we've all got like interesting stories to tell, every single one of us. So to be in a position where people are actually interested in helping me tell that story and, you know, financing doing it, it was unbelievable. Couldn't believe that was going to happen. So I jumped at that, the chance to pen the book. Picked a ghostwriter called Sophia Takur, who's an amazing young lady who's a spoken word expert.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully with her, she's quite young. She's the same age as one of my daughters. And I felt like having that younger element in there with my older element hopefully spans across the generations with the book racing. And, it's about me. It starts off with me as a young man, the kind of young man I was and how I was raised and not really having my father around and stuff like that. Experience overt racism back then where it was in your face by even your own mates.
Yeah.
And so it mentions a lot of that. And then it sort of talks a little bit about society, some of the things we can do. It brings out some harrowing stats and statistics as well about being black in this country and in the world, as actually some of the things that people don't quite, sometimes they don't, I don't think people believe or get it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, or they think, what's all this racism stuff about? But when you see some of the statistics, it kind of drives it home that there is a serious problem in this world that has gone on for way, way too long that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, I still have it with, you know, people I know, you know, talking about certain things, and then I listen to stories about certain, you know, there's stories about racism and that, and it does make you think long and hard about it, and makes you realize that there is still a problem and there is stuff going on, and it, you know, it's not acceptable, and it's sort of a bit of a wake-up call, because obviously I live here, I'm white, I don't sort of experience anything like it, but it's when you do hear about it and then you see it, or you sort of hear from friends about it, it's like, this is something that needs exploring, like on a monumental level, doesn't it? And it needs people like you to talk about it, to get it out there, to make people realize that it does happen.
Yeah. One of the most, for me, one of the strangest things is, because I've mentioned this a lot, and that like you have the working class white person, your average working class white person who's worked really, really hard. Thinks to themselves, well, I haven't had a leg up, you know, like I've worked really hard for what I have. Maybe someone like yourself, Jason, or your family, maybe, right? So what's all this racism about? I haven't had it easy. I'm not white privileged. But what people fail to understand is that, so if you can think about being, you know, working class white person and working really hard for what you have, right? A black person goes through that same class issue as well, because we're mostly working class too. But then if you add the added caveat of being black to that, which you don't actually have when you're white, then hopefully you'd think that they would be able to understand, well, actually, if I look at it from that perspective, I can get it now, because I found it hard enough as a middle class, as a working class white guy, I found it hard enough. Or my dad did working, you know, or my mum did working. So, geez, and we're white. So imagine how hard it is if you're black.
It's a simple equation, isn't it? It's not rocket science. It's just like that's because of it. It's systematic. That's it. It's there. It's been happening. So, you know, it's not a dig at anyone. It's just it is, but you know what I mean? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course. And I would just wonder that I would have just loved to have thought that those people would get it, you know, when you sort of look at it from that perspective, that, yeah, you know what, maybe there is something that's wrong that needs to be addressed. Because we just want people to have the conversation. We just want to open up the conversation and discuss it. We don't want people to just deny it. Do you know what I mean? Because it exists.
Yeah. Well, the denial thing is just, we're just in that repetitive circle again, isn't we? It just keeps, nothing gets done.
Exactly.
Stop making things difficult. This is an obviously good thing. This is the right thing to do. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mate, what's the book called? I don't think we've said what the actual book title is.
Everyone Versus Racism. And it's a letter to my children. That's the format. So I've written it to my children and grandchildren, but the format is, you know, it's to wider society, to be honest. Yeah. And on the first page, you have that amazing picture that was taken by Dylan Martinez in black and white, you know?
The iconic image.
I mean, that dude, Dylan Martinez, his picture, he's changed my life, mate.
Yeah. You know? He has. Where can people buy it? Is it out now?
Yep, it's out now. You can get it from Amazon. You can get it from WH Smith's, Waterstones, also Tesco's, not mistaken. So you can pretty much get it from most outlets.
Mate, what's next year got in store? You know, we're coming to the end of 2020. What's on the cards for 2021?
For me, I would like to get back to a little bit of normality, to be honest. So hopefully UKAI starts to really makes a difference. Like I said, my field is education, and then I've got some plans, some big plans, working with these pupil referral units. I want to change the lives of some of those children in those units.
Yeah.
So UKAI for me and for all four of us. And then on top of that, I would like to sort of maybe push out some fitness content, stuff like that, because obviously that's quite close to my heart. So I would say UKAI and fitness.
Keep driving the fitness.
Get some online content going, and some bits and bobs in that industry, I think would be, yeah.
I've got a couple more questions for you.
Yeah.
Then I've got to click over to Instagram because people send in questions, and I'll pick one out, and whoever I pick out, they get
the Talisca sea salted caramel gift set.
Everyone's a winner. Mate, I always finish on the same sort of question, but I think the question before I finish is probably a really important one, because I'd like to get your view on it, because obviously only yourself will know, coming from where you do. Mate, do you think things are changing when it comes to racism? I hope you say yes. And are things getting better?
Well, if I said they hadn't changed, for me, I've just got to say it from my perspective, and things have got better, because when I was growing up, racism was over all the time, every day, on TV, in your face, even your mates, it was over, it was just there, and it was just part of everyday life. Yeah. Now, I would suggest it's more covert. When I say covert, it's just embedded in society, and it's systemic, you know. So some of the things that happen to us are not always obvious, but they're there and they're happening. So in that respect, the overt racism is not eradicated, but it's not as prevalent as it used to be. Okay.
Yeah.
And now we're just left with the systemic and the unconscious bias, which has always been there along with the overt racism. So we are getting there, but it's a long old slog. Yeah. And we just have to persevere and keep fighting the good fight, because eventually, you know, we will get to a place where there is a level playing field and everyone lives together happily.
Yeah, it's like I hope I'm right in thinking that like society is like a person, and the older it gets, the more, the wiser and better it becomes. But
it becomes,
I'd agree with you that there's a long way to go, and I suppose you know, education is the best way to combat it, surely.
Yeah, it's key, and especially educating our young children, because it's their society. Tomorrow's society is their society, and if we can get them right, get their mindsets in the right place, then obviously later on things will be better, you know.
Yeah. Ending on a slightly lighter note, what advice would you give? And I like this one because we always talk about the mental health and the physical health, and it's something that you obviously are very, very invested in. But what advice would you give to people to maintain good mental health and physical health?
So the things that I do that really, really help me on a mental footing, obviously the first thing, as you know, Jace, is training, right? Training for me, I think I've heard you say as well, that it does more for you mentally than it does for you physically. It's nice to look good and have an half decent body, okay, but it doesn't half really put you in a headspace where you can let out a lot of frustrations, especially coupling that with the martial. When I say training, that includes martial arts. So yeah, being able to hit pads and grapple, because I do a bit of jiu-jitsu, a bit of my Muay Thai, it really does allow you to let your frustrations out on the mat and so on, on the bag, so you don't have to prove anything when you get out there on the street, you know. One of my tips is laughter. I like to laugh a lot, so like I'll watch comedies. You got your favorite comedies, you know. One of mine's that most people know, the comedy where the guys go away on the stag do in America.
Yeah.
I forgot what it's called now. But there's about three of them. So I like to laugh a lot. Laughter does so much for you as well, because obviously it releases those endorphins, yeah, doesn't it? Another thing I do is whenever you do good for other people, it leaves me with a really nice warm feeling when someone appreciates something I've done something for them. Yeah. It's almost a bit of addictive, a bit of a drug for me. Like, I do like to do things for people that are in and around me, like my family and my friends, because I really like the appreciation that they and the love that they give me back in return. That's really good for you, for your mental well-being. And also, meditation is the last one, but it's the one that I've added most recently. And I don't get to do it as much as I would like, but having that quiet time, that space where you can meditate for 15 minutes or so, and just be in that quiet space, it really, really does work. And I wish I could do more of it. But those are my tips. Those are the things that I like to do to you know, keep me in a good headspace.
Yeah, 100% agree with you, mate. And also, the whole being kind to people and doing things for people, it gives you a much greater sense of purpose, I think. There's a lot
of
purpose.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does.
Again, it's something I've been thinking about over the recent sort of year, I suppose. But yeah, mate, I 100% agree. So everyone should listen to Patrick. Right, what I'm going to do now real quickly is flick over to Instagram. So, hi guys, it feels like we will be seeing this amazing and inspiring picture for many years to come. It's such an iconic and powerful moment. How does it feel to play such an important role in our history? Which I think you have. That's quite a powerful thing to think about.
It is. It's one of those things that when you're in the middle of it, whilst it's still unfolding, you kind of don't really appreciate it. But I know that in years to come, I'm going to look back and go, wow, like, this is huge. Just to add to that, so I'm on the advisory board of a business called the Black Business Institute.
Yeah.
So, you know, people can follow them at Black Business Institute. And they've got a video which starts back right in the 1400s, right up until the present day. And it sort of touches on, you know, oppression of Black people, civil rights, all sorts, all the way through the ages. You've got a clip of Enoch Powell in there. There's a clip of a lot of people throughout history. And I'm at the very end. And when I saw that, that really, like, you know, put home how, like, you know, that I'm part of history. Like, do you know what I mean? It was like, wow, all these powerful moments in history. And I'm at the very end of it, you know. Mandela's there. There's a lot of things that happen in history that's on this video, and I'm at the very, very end of it, and it's like, wow.
Mate, that's awesome. And it's also, you, like, there's a legacy there for your kids and grandkids to be proud of as well.
Yeah,
it's fucking powerful. Brilliant, Patrick. it's awesome having you on. I really, really appreciate you coming on. I've really enjoyed talking to you. I hope we get to meet up at some point. We're not that far from each other. So if there's anything you've got going on you want me to help out with, get involved with, let me know, because I'd be really proud to do that.
Well, cheers, Jason. I really appreciate it, man.
Thanks very much to Patrick. Hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you don't already, and follow me and the Book of Man for the latest news. Thanks again to Talisca for supporting this podcast, and thanks again to you for listening. Take it easy, and I'll see you soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.